This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Lecture Series. My name is Cheryl Peach and I'm a program scientist here at the Birch Aquarium. It's my great pleasure this evening to introduce our speaker, Dr. Falk Feddersen. Falk is a professor here of physical oceanography. He does excellent work, as you'll see, trying to understand a very important topic, that is how pollutants are transported in the coastal zone. Falk actually began his academic career here as a graduate student. He moved from Scripps only for a couple of years. He went to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where he was a postdoctoral scholar. And then he returned to Scripps and made his way through research appointments and ultimately into the professor series, where he now is a full professor. He studies a whole variety of different processes in the surf zone, including waves, currents, the transport of pollutants, all sorts of things related to nearshore oceanography. He uses a whole variety of different processes, everything from observations out in the field to modeling back in the laboratory based on those observations. His research is incredibly important, as you might imagine. It's incredibly important to us here in the local area. He's done a great deal of field work here in the Southern California region, from La Jolla to Huntington Beach and also Imperial Beach. He's also done some work on the East Coast in North Carolina, Duck, North Carolina, and New River Inlet. And so I hope that you're going to enjoy what Falk has to tell us today and appreciate the importance of this really fundamental research into how pollutants are transported in the surf zone. And Falk, it's a great pleasure to have you.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm going to talk today about, the title of the talk is Following the Flow of Pollutants. But it's really about transport and mixing in the surf zone. What do I mean first by the surf zone? The surf zone is the region close to the coast where the waves are breaking. So this is a photograph from someone standing on the beach. This is our dye release contraption, essentially, and it's pouring this pink dye into the water, right? I'll tell you why we do that in a second. So, and this here, where the waves begin breaking, is sort of generally thought of as the region of the surf zone, right? So, and what we do to study pollutants in the surf zone is we create a fake pollutant, this rhodamine dye, and we pour it in very slowly, and then it moves along, and it goes out, and it gets transported down the coast, and it also gets mixed. And by studying this sort of thing, we can get an idea on how pollutants like sewage that's dumped into the water at the beach gets transported and mixed. So why do we care? Well, coastal waters are extremely important. And just some simple statistics, coastal tourism and recreation created 1.6 million jobs in the year 2000. It's a little old number, I'm sure it's more now. And in California, there's more than 100 million visitors to the beach a year, and this generates $9 billion in economic impacts. And so what happens is that when you have coastal communities, like what happened earlier in the last decade up at Huntington Beach, where you've got chronic sewage spills that are closing, making the beaches unsafe to swim in and getting people sick. When those beaches close, then tourists don't go to the beach and an entire community can suffer. Okay, so I just showed you this image here, this dye plume here. This is just probably 10 meters in width, so about 30 feet, 33 feet or so. So this is what a dye plume looks like from an aircraft. And this span here is about 500 meters or 500 yards. This is the beach at Imperial Beach. So this is the Tijuana River estuary back here. This is the Imperial Beach Pier. And we are pouring in dye at this location. And it's getting transported down the beach. And it's also getting mixed out. It's pretty cool to look at. Okay, well, why is this sort of thing important? And I alluded to the sewage spills, right? But here's an actual example. This is from the Union Tribune back in 2000. And at this location here, about 6 miles south of the border, south of the U.S.-Mexico border, which is right here. So let me just orient you. This is San Diego here, Point Loma, Coronado, the San Diego Bay, Imperial Beach, the border located here, And then down here is this place called Punta Mandera. And at this location, raw sewage gets just dumped right onto the beach. And at this time, on this satellite image, you can see the plume of sediment. So it's both raw sewage and sediment. You can see the plume of sediment associated with the sewage making its way up the coast, getting all the way up to Coronado. And you can imagine that this is not a good situation for the communities all along here, both in Mexico and in the United States. Right? So this is the general problem. This is a sign that was posted actually right just north of the Scripps Pier a couple of years ago when there was a sewage spill down at La Jolla Shores. And basically, you're not wanting to go into the water when it's like this, right? Okay, so what happens? Is this really a problem? Well, it's been estimated that 600,000 to 1.4 million gastrointestinal illnesses occur a year in LA and Orange counties combined. And that the economic impacts are $300 million of lost time at work and these sorts of things and costs, hospitalization costs and these sorts of things for gastrointestinal illnesses a year in the United States. This is only gastrointestinal illness, that's associated with going into dirty water at the beach. There's obviously much more gastrointestinal illness in the country. But there's also ear, eye, respiratory, and skin infections that can be associated with going into dirty, polluted water. Skin infections can include antibiotic-resistant staph infections now. There's studies showing this as well. Okay, so it's a problem. So how have communities sort of dealt with this sort of thing? Well, what they do is they go out and they test for what they call fecal indicator bacteria, or FIB for short. And these are bacteria that are associated with fecal matter, what gets flushed down the toilet. But it does not mean it actually is fecal matter. It's just associated with it. It's an indicator of it. And essentially, there's a class of bacteria called enterococci, and if it's greater than some amount, 104 coliform-forming units per milliliter, the beach gets closed for 3 days. Okay? There's extensive monitoring from Point Conception to the border, 600 sites, 155 in San Diego County, and less than 10% of the high-use beaches, though. And 87,000 tests a year, almost 16,000 in San Diego, 3 million annually just for the tests. Okay, that's it, just for the materials to buy, to pay for the testing equipment. Okay, but there's issues with this. One of the issues is, and I'll get into this, is that there's a 24-hour turnaround time minimum for fecal indicator bacteria sampling. The second issue is this issue of transport and mixing, because once there's a pollution spill, the water doesn't stay where it was spilled. The water moves up and down the coast, and it gets diluted. So we're going to look at each of these issues sort of like separately. Okay, so this here is an aerial photograph of the Imperial Beach region. Here's Imperial Beach. This is the Tijuana River estuary. This is the pier. And then up here you can see San Diego and Coronado. Okay. So this photograph was taken just after a heavy rain period, and you can see how brown the water here is in the Tijuana River estuary. And the opening of the estuary is just off the end of this photograph, but you can see this chocolate water that has a lot of sediment in it getting advected up the coast and then turning into this gigantic plume here. Now, the brown thing in here is sediment, but almost certainly associated with this water is a whole lot of really, really bad things that you do not want to be, you do not want to go into the water at this point in time. There was a graduate student from Scripps who was doing sampling work inside the estuary, not even when it was raining, and she contracted hepatitis A from the thing. Yeah, it's not good. Okay, so what do? Someone goes out and takes a water sample in knee-deep water. They go back to the lab and they culture the bacteria in a cell like this. And it takes 24 hours for the bacteria to grow, and then you get all these little colonies here. And then you count up the colonies, and if there are more colonies per gridded area and stuff like that that exceeds something, then you go back and you close the beach, and you close the beach for 3 days. But the beach may no longer be contaminated. Okay, so this is a problem. There's not an easy solution. Different people are working on different aspects of this. But one aspect is if you could understand the source of pollution to the beach and you understood how things were transported and mixed, or when I say mixed, I also mean diluted or dispersed, right? If you could understand these sorts of things, then you might be able to get a better handle on when the beaches should be open, when the beaches should be closed, and how bad sewage spills are in general for ecosystems or for humans and economics and that sort of thing. So let's talk about transport. What I mean by transport is how stuff that's in the water gets moved up and down the coast, okay? So these things get moved up and down the coast by surf zone and intershelf currents. Well, what do I mean by the surf zone? Surf zone, again, is this region close to shore, generally within 100 meters, but depends on how big the waves are, really, where the waves are breaking. And the intershelf is the region offshore of the surf zone where wave breaking is no longer really important, right? So sort of like 5 to 8 meters water depth out here, okay? In the surf zone, when you get waves coming in at an angle, they break and they drive a current that goes down the beach. And in this case, the waves were coming from the south and they're breaking and they're driving a current that goes up the beach. You can see this because we're injecting dye at this location right here. And for the most part, the dye has been going, dye's almost reached the Imperial Beach Pier. So it's a nice current. You know, it's moving slowly, but it's moving along. But out of the inner shelf, there's barely any mean current. If you put dye in here, it would barely move. Okay. So I can say this, but in order for you to believe me, these things are actually quite different. So the green is surf zone currents. The blue is inner shelf currents, 320 meters offshore of the surf zone. This is 800 hours, which is approximately 5 weeks worth of data. And this is the longshore current. So this is the current that goes up and down coast. It's actually from Huntington Beach. And it goes from 0.6 meters per second to minus 0.4 meters per second. You can think of 0.6 meter per second as like 1.5 miles per hour, if that helps. Okay, so, but what you can see is that the green curve here, the currents are much stronger and they fluctuate up and down. They're generally much stronger and they fluctuate in a manner that's uncorrelated with the currents offshore. So in order to understand transport of pollutants at the surf zone, you need to know what the surf zone longshore currents is. And this is something that, believe it or not, has not been considered by the community previously in their consideration of where pollution goes. Okay, so how do we test whether we can predict the transport of stuff? So we did an experiment in Huntington Beach in the fall of 2006. It's called HBO6. This is an aerial photo or Google image photograph of the Huntington Beach region. For those of you that are familiar with Orange County, this is the Santa Ana River mouth, and this is the Talbot Marsh. So Newport Beach is just to the south, and the city of Huntington Beach is up north. This is the Huntington Beach State Park, and there's the Orange County Sanitation District is right here. This is where they process all of their sanitation stuff. Okay? We had this stretch of beach, a 1 kilometer stretch of beach that we owned for about 2 months. It's great. So what do we do there? Well, we put in these tripods into the water, we jet them into the sand so these are fixed in place, and what they have on them are current meters and pressure sensors and temperature sensors and other instruments that can measure dye concentration, these sorts of things. We put out a cross-shore array of them, and then and these guys measure the waves and currents and stuff, and then we also had a jet ski that would drive around and could either measure the bathymetry or measure the dye concentration. I'll tell you a little bit about that later. And then we also did sort of bottle samples, the old-fashioned way, just as backup stuff. This is a graduate student. Gonna get sprayed, really. So, but from these tripods here, we can measure the longshore current. This we can measure the thing that's transporting stuff up and down the coast. And then we can also then run a computer model that includes the physics of wave breaking that drive currents up and down the coast. And this model uses another wave model that's been developed here at Scripps. It's part of the CDIP network. And that model drives another model that pushes the currents up and down the coast. And then what we can do is we can say, all right, well, how good a job do we actually do? And this is This is basically a true nowcast. It's not like we collected some data and then later on we're going to fiddle our model until we get some sort of perfect answer. We actually just ran it in real time. And so what this is the longshore current. So this is the current that goes up and down the beach. This is time in days from September 12th, 35 days long. The blue is the observed surf zone longshore current. So it oscillates. And then the red is the model that is driven. And so overall, you can see that most of the time, the model does a pretty good job. There's some time during large south swell where there's a Newport Canyon just to the south of Huntington Beach, and it makes the waves do very, very interesting things that the model doesn't quite resolve. But overall, the predictions are pretty good. And what this means is that the surf zone transport can be modeled. So that when you have stuff in the surf zone, you want to know, okay, how quickly is it going up and down the coast? How big is this arrow? We can get a good idea of how big that arrow is. And it can be modeled. Okay. So then the next aspect is the mixing. How does stuff get mixed? And you can also think of this as dilution or dispersion. And in particular, how does it get mixed in the surf zone? Because stuff seems like it likes to stay here in the surf zone. So just back up a second. So if you went back 10 years ago and someone said, all right, well, what is the rate of mixing in the surf zone? And what does it depend on, right? People would basically like, I don't know. And they would put numbers into their models or numbers into their simulations and just ride with it. No one had ever made any measurements of how stuff, i.e. dye in this case, gets mixed in the surf zone. So this is the thing that we started doing, we started setting out to do about 10 years ago, and we've made a lot of progress. And so I'm going to tell you about that. So the first thing is, there's going to be a tiny little bit of math in this talk, and it's okay if you don't understand it, but really, the thing that I want you to understand is that this Greek symbol kappa right here is just a symbolic representation of something called the diffusivity. And the diffusivity is just a measure of mixing. It's how rapidly stuff spreads out, or it's how rapidly stuff dilutes. Okay, so a bigger kappa means more dilution, more spreading out. Smaller kappa means it doesn't spread out a lot. You can think of kappa as if you put a drop of milk into your coffee and you did it very carefully with an eyedropper and like the milk just stayed right in the center of your cup and then slowly spread out, that would be a small kappa, small diffusivity. If you put a drop of milk in and then you took your blender and stuck it in your coffee cup and blended, that'd be a high diffusivity, okay? So just keep that in mind. So for the surf zone mixing, there's kind of two ways that we've gone about doing this. And one I'm just gonna skim on. One way we would do it is with surf zone drifters. And what these drifters are PVC tubes about this long and about this wide that are ballasted, and they have an antenna that sticks up. So they're ballasted, so the top of the tube is basically right here at the water surface. And this antenna here is a GPS antenna, very accurate GPS antenna. So this drifter knows where it is. And then it also has this special ability, the way it's ballasted in the righting moment, and then it has this plate at the bottom, such that when a breaking wave hits it, it doesn't surf on shore. It just ducks right under the wave, kind of like a surfer does when they're duck diving. So it doesn't get pushed on shore by the wave. And so this is kind of like throwing a particle out into the surf zone, and then you can see what the particle does. Well, these are the kinds of things that we can then see from it. So this is what we call a spaghetti plot, but let me orient you first. On the bottom axis is the cross-shore coordinate X. So X is 0 is the shoreline, and this is 200 meters offshore. This is 900 meters here in the longshore. The beach is over here in the solid gray line, and then this dashed line represents the cross-shore location of the surf zone. This is where wave breaking starts. And what we do is where the open circles are is where we release the drifters. And then the lines are just the track that the drifter takes. So you can see the drifters were released up more on the upper part of the plot, and they slowly drifted down, generally. So they went to the south. And that's the transport part. But you can also see they wiggle all over the place, right? And if you did the thought experiment of putting like four drifters together at the same and releasing them at the same time in the same place, and you watch them go, if they were all together to start off with, after some period of time, they'd all have spread out. And that rate at which the drifters spread out is related to this diffusivity that I was talking about before. So you can use the drifter observations to estimate the diffusivity and to study its magnitude and what it depends on. And we've done a whole series of papers on this sort of thing, and this is just one of them. But I'm not going to talk any more about this because the pictures aren't as cool, really. So we can also estimate mixing by pouring this pink rhodamine dye into the surf zone and back into this photograph I keep showing. And the way that we do this is twofold. One is in this photograph here, this is our contraption that releases dye into the surf zone. What's underneath the water here is essentially a wheelbarrow. Okay? And then it has this elevated thing on it. You walk it out into the surf zone, boom, and you put these brackets down so it's stable, right? And then on here is basically a jerry can. This is what boaters use to put gas in, filled with this rhodamine dye. And then over here is a peristaltic pump with a battery pack, and it just basically pumps the dye out and down a tube here, and then releases dye slowly at a couple, like 2 milliliters per second. So it's just a very slow flow. And then we also have a GPS antenna here with a recorder, and it's so we know exactly where we're releasing the dye, because in order to do the analysis, you have to know where you put the dye in, obviously. So this is how we release the dye. And then the main way that we measure the dye is, well, we bought a jet ski. and the Navy paid us to buy a jet ski. Actually paid us to buy two. And then we retrofitted them. And so the first thing we did is we put a GPS antenna onto the jet ski, so we know exactly where the jet ski is. And we also put a little computer console there, which the driver can look at, so the driver can drive predetermined transect lines. So you drive it's like you're mowing the lawn, essentially, by doing the computer screen. And then we also added some instrumentation and plumbing. So we put in, this is not exactly like a very accurate, it's a schematic, it's not really what it looks like, but there are intakes now on the jet ski, plumbing intakes that suck up water as it's driving along, and it goes through some stuff to get rid of bubbles and stuff like that, and then eventually it hits a fluorometer. And the fluorometer measures the dye concentration. And it can measure the dye concentration because the dye is fluorescent. And what that means is that when you shine a light at a particular wavelength, a particular color of light onto the dye reacts by emitting light, shining light itself back. And so these fluorometers are specially designed so that they shoot a particular color of light out, and then when the dye will shoot a certain amount of color back at a certain level. And by measuring that level and turning it into a voltage and then digitizing it, we can actually measure the dye concentration in the surf zone. So it's a pretty cool little instrument and feat. Okay, so then, now that we have that, how do we actually go about measuring diffusivity, right? So if you imagine a schematic beach with a dye source right here, and typically in many, like in Huntington Beach and Imperial Beach, places where you're open to south swell, you typically get waves that come in at an angle and they drive a current up the beach, okay? And so what often happens is that you'll get a dye plume that looks like almost half of a smokestack plume. So a smokestack plume looks like this if there's no wind, right? But because there's a beach, it sort of looks like half of a smokestack plume coming up. And so what you can do is if you drive the jet ski in cross-shore transects at different downstream distances from the dye source, you're going to measure how the dye spreads out, how this plume spreads out. But what the color here doesn't show you is that the dye is going to be concentrated here and it's going to be less concentrated here because it's spread out. Okay? So this is the strategy, driving cross-shore transects. And what we do is then we set up on the either on the computer screen, or if they're very, very close transects, we'll sometimes take cones and line cones up on the beach. So there's a cone close to the water and a cone up on the on top of the berm. And then the driver from offshore lines up the cones and says, all right, I'm driving that line. So it's almost like, I don't know, what pilots do to land on aircraft carriers or something like that. So what does it look like? This is not a very dramatic picture. This was the smallest day, the day we did dye release of the smallest waves at Huntington Beach. And so you can see dye really concentrated here close to the shoreline. And then the colors get bled out a little bit on the projector, but you can see a plume, some dye out here, a little bit of dye here. But then there's clear water in between the dye. And so this the waves are small, and this is a lull, and the jet ski is not having to do much to drive on this cross shore transect. But what we do want to do is we want to do these kinds of experiments in lots of different types of wave conditions. We want to do it both when the waves are extremely small and when the waves are basically as big as we can safely drive the jet ski. And the reason for that is because we would imagine that the default hypothesis would be that when the waves are small, maybe the mixing, the diffusivity, that stirring thing that I told you about is small. And when the waves are big, one might imagine that it's very big, right? So this is something that we can test. Okay, so when you drive around like this, what does the data actually look like? So this here is the beach. This, again, the cross-shore coordinate. So x equals 0 is the shoreline. This is 250 meters. That's 600 meters. And then the colors are the cross-shore transects that were all the transects that were driven by the jet skis. So we didn't chop out just the cross-shore transects. A little bit more visually interesting. The colors represent the dye concentration. And then this dashed line here is the outer limit of the surf zone. That's where the wave breaking begins on this day. The green is the dye source. And what happens is that the current is going up the beach. And so what happens is the dye gets released, and it slowly migrates its way up the coast. And it also, as it migrates its way up the coast, you can see the plume goes from being very narrow to spreading out, to spreading out, to spreading out. And the colors near the shoreline get fainter and fainter, meaning the dye is diluting. So it's spreading, and it's diluting as it's going up. So we did 6 of these dye releases, and they were analyzed in this paper, Clark et al., by my graduate student. And now comes the math part, and I was advised that this may not be the this may have been a mistake. But in case there are people who enjoy this sort of thing, you can come up with a simple model for this kind of behavior, all right? And that simple model is kind of like a half smokestack plume, where V is now the current that's going down the beach, C is the concentration of dye, Y is the alongshore coordinate. So this is like the alongshore advection of dye is getting balanced by the cross-shore mixing of dye, where remember kappa is that diffusivity, right? So this looks scary, it's really not all that scary, right? You can change it from one equation to another equation. And for those of you who took some physics may remember that this is the classic heat equation here. You've converted this down to a heat equation. And that there's a solution to this heat equation that gives you a diffusivity. You can actually estimate the diffusivity from this quantity here, where the sigma squared surf is defined as this crazy integral. Well, it's not that crazy. And what sigma squared surf really is, sigma surf is really just the cross-shore length scale of the tracer. It's how wide is that tracer patch, right? And so when you square it, it becomes that the length of that tracer patch squared. Okay, well, what do I really mean? So here's the sigma surf, right? When you're close to the dye source, it's narrow. It's this width. When you're further away from the dye source, it's wider. Right? So by looking at the rate at which this plume width grows, you can estimate, from basic theory, you can estimate this diffusivity quantity. Okay, so what does it actually look like? So here's this squared length scale here, is the width of the plume squared versus, this is a time coordinate, but it's really downstream distance. And what we do is we fit a curve to these black symbols where the dye was well contained inside the surf zone, because we're interested in this mixing inside the surf zone. And when you fit that line, it's nice and linear, which is what the theory says it should be, and you get a diffusivity of 0.5 meters squared per second. So this in and of itself is, it's hard to relate this to anything else. Like, you know, your coffee would get blended up very rapidly if the diffusivity were 0.5 meters squared per second. But in different sorts of contexts, it's the diffusivity in Niagara Falls would be much larger than that. Okay, so we calculated the diffusivity on five different days. Okay, now we also did some computer modeling. So the what you're looking at here is dye concentration in this panel and vorticity in this panel. Vorticity is kind of like the spin of the water. So it's sometimes when you're going along, the water can turn like this, and sometimes it can turn the opposite way. And so if it's red, the water's turning one direction. If it's blue, the water's turning the other direction. Just to orient you, the x-axis is the same as all the other plots, so it's the cross-shore coordinate, and the y-axis is the along-shore coordinate. This is the outer limit of the surf zone, and this is where the dye is released. Okay? So if we now play it, looks pretty cool. So you can see the dye instantaneously is doing lots of different types of things. It's meandering, it's moving around, it's breaking up, it's getting ejected, it's doing all kinds of stuff. And if you pay really close attention, you see the vertical structures that are doing this, they're doing the stirring of the dye, right? But what happens is that this is sort of like the instantaneous view, right? The theory says, well, we don't really want the instantaneous view. We want to see what happens on average. And so these are all the jet ski passes. And what your eye can do is you can average them. And what you can do on a computer is you can actually average them together yourself. This is what the computer, that simulation that I just showed you, if you look at a whole long time that's equivalent to the same time that we had the jet ski out, this is what you get as the average dye concentration. So you can see this is where we put the dye in, and the plume spreads out on average at this rate here. And now we can do the same calculation that we did for the observations. We can do the same calculation now inside the model. Right? The model's generating all these eddies and sending the dye this way and that way, just like in the ocean. But when you look at the mean and you calculate the observed diffusivity, this kappa quantity, against this model diffusivity for the five cases that we were able to do this for, this is what you get. So this is 0 to 3. The dashed line is the one-to-one line, and the error bars here are sort of like the error bars on the thing. And what you see is that these five things pretty much all lie in this one-to-one line. And when things lie on a one-to-one line, that means the observations and the model are telling you the same thing, or very, very similar things. And what this means is that the dilution or the dispersion of surf zone contaminants, pathogens, this sort of thing, can essentially be predicted, which is very cool. So we have both the transport part and we have the dilution or the dispersion mixing part down. Okay, so what does this mean? Progress. That's essentially what it means. There's still a lot more work to be done, and these models are extremely, it's not like, let's just say they take a long time to run because they have a lot of detailed physics in them. If someone said, oh my God, there's a pollution spill at this place, can you run it? And stuff like that, I'd be like, well, at first I need to set it up, and I need to do this, and I need to get cluster time, and stuff like that. So there's more things that need to be done, but that certainly can be done, okay? But there's also physics, new physics, that also needs to be understood. And what I've been telling you about is about the mixing inside the surf zone, right? But there's more to it than that. And that is that there's exchange between the surf zone and the inner shelf. However, I put a question mark here because we do not know how much exchange and at what rate. All we know that it's a lot slower than the diffusion in the surf zone. So, but we've done some experiments on this. And so what we've done at Imperial Beach is, you see where this dotted yellow line is? So we take like a 24-foot whaler and we tow instruments behind it in about 5 meters water depth, which is where this yellow line is. But you can imagine that can get a little scary because you're really close to the beach where the waves are breaking, driving a boat sideways as waves are coming up, and you're doing this sort of thing. So it's a little sketchy. In this case, dye was released right here where this purple star is. And what happens when you drive the boat like this? So we release dye in this location, drive the boat like this. And then this is a function of the alongshore, so along this track. So almost 900 meters worth, or 900 yards, if you prefer. This is dye in parts per billion, and this is also the temperature. And this is now the dye concentration as a function of the vertical. So 0.5 meters below the surface to just over 3 meters below the surface. And what you can see is that the dye concentration is sometimes there's dye, and sometimes there's no dye. And this concentration is banded, and it's vertically uniform. So it's like dye, no dye, dye, no dye, but it's up, it's over this entire upper 3 meters. The other thing that's interesting is that if you really look at the dye and the temperature, it's again a little hard to see with this projector, but there's plenty of times where the dye is elevated and the temperature is also elevated, and that the dye is low and the temperature is low. And what this is that the water inside the surf zone is generally warmer than the water offshore. And the dye is also being injected into the surf zone. So when rip currents eject dye offshore, and you can see little rip heads in these in this image, when they eject dye offshore, they bring not only the dye-rich water, but they bring warmer water. So we can use both of them as a signal of exchange between the surf zone and the inner shelf. Okay. So this is sort of like surf zone inner shelf connections, but we've also have other studies where we've looked at tidal inlets and looked at the connections between tidal inlets, surf zone, and inner shelf plume connections. So this is from the New River Inlet, which is on the southern part of southern North Carolina coast. And what we did is we just, about a kilometer up the inlet, we poured 20 gallons of this rhodamine dye into the water, and then it was like up here, and it just cruised down, and now it's about to come out this inlet mouth here. And then a little while later, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes later, the dye that was here, we originally released it up here. The dye that was here is now spread out like this. One way that we're now measuring this dye is, obviously, this is an aerial photograph from a plane. And one of the limitations with this is that you can take all the pictures that you want, but A, they're not georeferenced, so you don't know where they are. And B, you don't know, you can say, oh yeah, there's dye here, but you can't say what the concentration of dye is. You can't do a quantitative analysis. So what we did during this experiment is we flew what's called a hyperspectral imager on a plane that had a very accurate GPS antenna and could make georeferenced measurements of where it was looking at. And so by looking at the different colors of the water surface, at different colors of light, and doing analysis at the colors of light that correspond to the absorption and the emission wavelengths of the dye, and we also drove the jet ski around, and with the jet ski, we're able to calibrate the camera on the plane. We can actually make quantitative estimates of dye. So what this movie played here was a movie of calibrated in parts per billion dye concentration as it left the inlet. So I'm going to play this again, but just now to orient you, this here is the New River Inlet up here, and this is the coast, and there's a shoal, and the dye is going down the coast. The New River Inlet bathymetry is up here near y equals zero. This is the cross-shore direction, and then there's a shoal here, and the coastline goes down this way. If we play this again, you can see the dye getting poured into the inlet. This is where we released it. And then the plane is just flying over, making these passes. And eventually the plane gets higher and higher and higher so that you get a better field of view. But now we can see the dye coming out the inlet, making this left-hand turn, coming down. And there's all kinds of interesting sort of like whirly structures here in the dye field. But the main thing to note is, at least on this day, the dye liked to stay pretty close to the coast. It didn't get jetted offshore, and it doesn't look like it's diluting much with the water just offshore. So what this means is, at this location here, they have hog farms, 50, 60 kilometers up this river here, and when there's a lot of rain, these hog farms dump a lot of poop, for lack of a better word, pig poop, into the river that gets flushed out this inlet. And when that happens, you cannot be in the water here in the inlet. And, well, can you be in the water to the south of the inlet or the water to the north of the inlet? Or does that water just go straight offshore? And it can do all those things, but it depends on the conditions. And we now have the observations. This is just one example. We now have the observations and the models, basically, to figure out why it's doing what it's doing and then be able to predict it for public health and safety and these sorts of things. And so this talk that I gave was not just sort of like representative of just me and my work. So there's a lot of people that I need to acknowledge who've helped out in this. A number of graduate students, including three students who have gotten their PhD, Dave Clark, Melissa Omond, and Meg Rippey, and then Kai Haley Rosendahl, who's a fourth-year graduate student working with me. And then various other faculty members, both at Scripps and Woods Hole and Stanford. And then we have this incredible field crew, engineers and technicians, who can really make things happen, and none of our work would be possible without them. And then work has primarily been funded by the National Science Foundation, the Office of Naval Research, and Sea Grant and NOAA, and then California Coastal Conservancy and the NDSCG Fellowship has also provided a lot of support. So thanks to them. Wouldn't be possible without it. And then that's the end. So if you have any questions, thank you. There's a row here. So you got your hand up first. So,
Do the hog farmers believe that the pollutants are being dispersed way off into the sea?
You know, I actually don't know what the hog farmers believe or don't believe. The question was whether the hog farmers that are upstream of the New River Inlet in North Carolina, whether they believe that the water just whether it goes offshore, what the water does, or if they're really having an impact, I guess. The answer to that question is I don't know. But when we did this experiment in 2012. We went in 2010 to do a reconnaissance mission, but it was like November, and it just rained a bunch, and we could not go into the water. It's like a situation. It was so nasty. You don't even want to be in a inflatable boat in that inlet and that sort of thing. Like, it's just off limits. It's radical. Sorry.
The experiments you mentioned use this rhodamine dye, but real pollutants, some are water soluble, some are not water soluble, some float on top like an oil slick, some sink to the bottom. I guess they're just beginning this kind of work.
Exactly. So the question was, this rhodamine dye that we're using is essentially it's a particular kind of tracer, but real pollutants maybe are not. And some are water soluble, some are not. Some pollutants are alive and they die. Some pollutants may grow. They have a certain level of concentration. There may be a certain number of critters living in there, but they may encounter food and they may like to grow, right? So what I'm addressing here is only the physical processes that are driving this, not the biological processes and not the chemical processes. So that's, unfortunately, well, I'm a physical oceanographer, so these things don't seem terribly complicated to me, but those other processes do seem very complicated to me. But I have collaborators, and some of those people I acknowledge there, and they think about these things. You had your hand up.
Have you replicated the this for the oil spills and done any studies of that similar nature?
So the question was whether we had done these sort of studies with oil spills. The answer essentially is no. And so the reason why, so first of all, obviously you can't just dump a bunch of oil into the beach and be like, yeah, we want to check out where it's going to go. We don't care about those kids playing in the sand, you know. Generally the data on oil spills, right, is from farther offshore. But you know, like with a Deepwater Horizon thing, some of that stuff is getting onshore, and so we're not actually looking at that. But there are other groups of people who are doing sort of some beach process things on the coastal beaches of the Gulf there. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Have you done anything like this with our Point Loma Sewage Treatment Center, where they dump way offshore and see what happens, what actually happens to all that stuff that we don't have to process two times?
Yes. So the question is whether the sewage that's being released at the Point Loma outfall, whether I have studied that. And I have not studied that, but other people do study it. Other people at Scripps do study it. So what they do is a number of things. One is they scuba dive out there and they look at the ecosystems on the bottom to see whether the sewage is having an impact. The other thing that they do is they drive these kinds of robotic underwater vehicles that can measure sort of things that like suspended solids in the water column. It's also an optical measurement. It's like the color of the water, essentially. And they can drive these things around near the plume, near where the outfall is, and measure how rapidly the plume gets diluted and where it goes to the left or to the right. In general, the Point Loma one, it would be extremely rare oceanographically for that plume to actually surface and make its way to the coast that could affect humans. Thing. There's an outfall at the South Bay, just offshore of of the U.S.-Mexico border, that's only in 30 meters water depth, and that bad boy can outfall. That bad boy can outcrop, and that pollution can come into shore. Yes, Jules.
Did you put fluorometers on your drifters?
We did not put fluorometers on our drifters. The question was whether we put fluorometers on our drifters. No, we managed to put a temperature sensor on our drifters, but not a fluorometer. Yes?
Can this be applicable in any way to measuring the radiation that's coming out of Japan?
Well, that's a very nice question. And so the question was whether this is applicable to the radiation that's coming off of Japan from the Fukushima disaster. So the principles that I've talked about here are for what's happening in the mixing very close to the coast, right? So within a few hundred meters of the coast. And in that, the answer is yes. But for the larger scale mixing that takes a lot longer to happen, and because it's such a great distance between, let's say, Japan and the United States, right? That is a sort of, there are different processes at work there. The things that do the stirring, that spread the water out, are different really close to the coast relative to farther offshore. So in that initial dilution, the answer is yes. Wow. Okay, so like this right here. The question was, when we look at the average tracer concentration, that there was a plateau and that maybe it didn't dilute anymore as you were going downstream. And so, yeah, so what happens, and you can see it both in the observations and in the model, and this is just on this case here, this is why we put this line in for how wide the surf zone is. Because what we observe is that the dye gets mixed out to the width of the surf zone. And once it gets mixed out to the width of the surf zone, so when this line crosses with this line, at that point, the dye doesn't really mix out in the longshore that much anymore. And the same thing happens here. So what this is that there's mixing in the surf zone, and it's rapid and it's strong, right? But then once you've mixed into the surf zone, then maybe it slows down because now you're at the interface between this is where wave breaking begins and there's no wave breaking offshore. And the wave breaking is the thing that does the stirring. And so this is the thing that I alluded to about this exchange between the surf zone and inner shelf, that it's this part here, this long time downstream thing that we are trying to get a handle on and understand now. So the question is whether our research has any implications for where they stick the signs on for closing the beach. So at this point in time, no. But the hope is that in the future, particularly in chronically impacted places like the border region, which is really, really can be very, very impacted, that one could develop sort of like a real-time modeling system that would take into account all the physics of the surf zone, the estuary, and the region offshore, and that could be used to actually both hindcast pollution events. That's how you first have to test it, and then it could be used in an operational mode. And these sorts of things are feasible now. It's just getting the will to construct something like this. So me and other people at Scripps are in consultation with people at the International Boundary Water Commission, with the EPA, these sorts of things, getting them interested. And people are interested, but it's a slow dance.
Time for one more question.
Yes.
In general, do you think you would prefer getting your data from the aerial surveying or from the in-situ measurements? Although I understand you have to go into the water to calibrate the sensor anyway.
Well, so it depends on what it is that we... So the question is, would we rather have the in-situ jet ski data or would we rather have the aerial data? So the thing that's nice about the aerial data is that you can see a much greater area at one time. The jet ski, even though you can drive it relatively rapidly, you're sort of stuck. The problem with the aerial observations is when they see foam from a breaking wave, all bets are off. It's noise, you can't use it anymore. So only the jet ski or other in-situ observations work inside the surf zone. But in the region offshore of the surf zone, you know, all of this is outside the region where the waves are breaking. And so for the region outside the waves are breaking or inside this inlet, then the aerial observations are better. But when we did this, we didn't know if it would work or not. So it's sort of one of those things, you got to try it. Physics says it should work, but there are complications, which, you know, largely works. Go ahead.
I was just wondering what the time frame is, both on the aerial data here and on the other
data. When we took the data or how long it took to take... Oh, yeah, okay, I'm sorry. So these observations here are about 5 hours worth. The aerial observations are about 5 hours worth. What did happen, unfortunately, is that at some point in time, they needed to refuel and they also needed to take a bathroom break. So they had to run to the airport close by, take care of business, and then come back out. So we had a gap of about an hour and 10 minutes. The jet skis, what we do is we started out with just sort of like sampling for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. And then at this later experiment in Imperial Beach, we sampled like for 6 or 8 hours. So what that eventually means is that the jet ski comes into the beach, gets refueled, drivers swap out and stuff because you get blasted if you're driving for that long period of time.
Well, thank you so much for great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.